Case number 20-1010, Local 23, American Federation of Musicians Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Ginsburg for the petitioner, Ms. Rajabaksi for the respondent.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Ginsburg, please proceed when you're ready.
Yes, good morning, your honors, and may it please the court, Matthew Ginsburg, on behalf of the petitioner, Local 23 of the American Federations of Musicians. Your honors, this case demonstrates concretely the importance of the right of employees to engage in Section 7 activity at their principal workplace. The musicians in this case routinely perform at the Tobin Center for the center's three principal performing arts companies, the symphony, the ballet, and the opera. There's no serious doubt that the Tobin Center and no other location constitutes the musicians' principal workplace throughout the annual performance season. On the weekend in question, the musicians sought to stand on the sidewalk in front of the Tobin Center's main entrance to hand out leaflets to patrons who were attending the ballet's opening weekend performance of Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty. The leaflets asked patrons to support the musicians' request that the ballet employ members of the musicians' union to perform live music to accompany the ballet's dancers, rather than use pre-recorded music as the ballet had planned. There was really no other location where the musicians could practically convey this message to their intended audience. Like most performing arts organizations, the ballet is supported by a relatively small number of committed patrons and benefactors who purchase subscriptions for the ballet's annual seasons of performances and who make financial contributions to support the ballet's ongoing operation. The musicians targeted these supporters with their leaflets because the musicians understood that the ballet cares a great deal about its audience's views on matters such as the use of live music. And the musicians reasonably expected that many of the ballet's most committed patrons and benefactors would be attending the opening weekend performances of the ballet's new presentation. Yet despite the musicians' strong connection to the Tobin Center and the fact that there was no other practical location where the musicians could exercise their Section 7 rights, the board upheld the Tobin Center's decision to prohibit the musicians from leafleting on the sidewalk outside the center's main entrance.
Mr. Ginsburg, New York 1, we recognize that the critical question left to the discretion of the board was, quote, whether individuals working for a contractor on another's premises should be considered employees or non-employees of the property owner. Does that suggest that it's within the board's discretion to apply the same test to contractor employees as applied to the non-employee union organizers in Leachmere?
So we have no dispute that the board has discretion in this area to change its rule.
Even to equate Section 7 employees like these to non-employees in Leachmere?
Well, if I can take your question in two bites. Yes, they could apply a test that they came up with, not this test for reasons I'll explain, to find some contractor employees are essentially equivalent to non-employees. But they can't apply the test they articulated here because it is not rational. It does not balance the property interest with the employee's Section 7 interest. It also is not the test that the board applied pre-New York, which is what it says it's doing here, but is actually not the case. And it certainly, we don't think, can apply that test to employees like these who have a very, very strong connection to the workplace and in any balancing ought to have some opportunity. The extent could be within the board's discretion, but some opportunity.
If we were to agree with you that the application here of the works regularly at the property owner's premises was arbitrary as applied and that the exclusively requirement was arbitrary as a requirement, what about the other ground, the other available means? Is that defective?
Yes.
Alternative means of communicating the message. And how so? What's the attack on that?
Well, the attack on that is that it is applying the same test as in Babcock and Wilcox and Leachmere, which is a test applied to non-employee union organizers who have only a derivative interest in exercising Section 7 rights on the property to individuals who are employees who have personal non-derivative interest in exercising their rights on the property.
Didn't the board here say these were derivative because they're not the employees of the Tobin Center?
I'm not sure the board said that specifically, but that we dispute that. You know, that the interests at play here are non-derivative interests. Now, obviously we acknowledge the relationship between the employees and the Tobin Center is one of employees and property owner, like in New York. But still, the particular Section 7 interest that must be considered in the balance is a personal non-derivative interest, unlike
this,
that.
This gets back a little bit to the question that Judge Pillard asked earlier, because if it's permissible to equate contractor employees to non-employee organizers, at least in some situations, if it's permissible, and then that's what the agency did here, then it seems like it's at least within the zone of permissibility. So your argument wouldn't be one that the agency is just barred from doing it on this criterion, right?
That's correct. So, for example, employees who had a very, had a very limited, loose relationship to the property might, when the balancing was complete, end up with the same rights as non-employee union organizers. Again, that would not be the case in a case like this one, where you have employees who are there routinely and primarily.
So you think on the facts of this case, there's just no, the board is just not permitted to come up with any test under which the, you know, reasonable alternative means of communication could be taken into account in a way that inures to the benefit of the property owner.
Okay, I'm sorry. Perhaps I misunderstood that piece of the question before. I think the board perhaps could come up with such a test. And in fact, if you look, I guess the way I would think about it is that the exclusively part of the board's test looks at whether the employees primarily work there. What are the strength of the relationship to the property, similar to and relies on cases like Postal Service, where the dissent in DiBartolo, where the question was, is there an alternative location where the employees can exercise their Section 7 rights? And so in a way, the second step of the board's test here sounds in the same vein. The problem with the test as the board has articulated it here, though, is that it is exactly those contractor employees who meet this very strict and, we argue, arbitrary test of regularly and exclusively, who then have to go on and yet again prove this no reasonable alternative test, which the board has already determined what is reasonable and what is not, and it's a very difficult test to make. So, I mean, the board could craft a test that takes into account reasonable alternatives. It's just not the test that they've articulated here.
So tell us more about that. Here we have a record where, on the one hand, there's a discussion of alternative non-trespassory means of going across the street. But then the board also throws in, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, without any record evidence one way or the other about social media or mass media, you know, how readily or effectively these patrons could be targeted by that, but they throw that in too. So how should we think about this? You talk about, I'm just throwing a lot of things on the table, but you talk about that it's an illusory difference to shift the burden on this prong from the property owner to, from the employees to the property owner. What do we have to decide, and what should we decide on this issue?
Well, I think if you agree with our argument that the first test about the sufficiency of the connection to the property is arbitrary,
I'm not saying one way or the other, but to isolate the inquiry, yes. Assume that we were to agree with you on the first part of the test.
Then I don't think you need to reach the second part of the test, because you would, I believe, remand to the board, and in doing so, they could consider the test as a whole. And for the reasons I explained, there are good reasons to let the board consider the test as a whole on remand.
And that's because, as you see it, the alternative means only becomes a relevant inquiry if the relationship between the employees and the center is tenuous in the way that analogizes it to the union members in Leachmere. The organizers in Leachmere.
Well, that would be, I think, a reasonable way for the board to think about it, but it's certainly not what the board did here. I mean, the board was very clear here that they said you only reach the second step if you surmount the first step of the regularly and exclusively test. And just to be very clear about it, we think the idea that you contractor employees have to show that they exclusively work for their contractor at a property is totally arbitrary, has no basis in the board's case law. So if you find that, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Right. So if we assume that you're right, just assume for argument's purposes that you're right on regularity and exclusivity, then there's this third prong of the test, reasonable alternative means. And the question becomes, so suppose the board constructed its inquiry so that it said, there's two independent bases that anyone could look at. You could look at regularity/exclusivity, or you could look at reasonable alternative means. Either one of them could be enough in any particular case to deem the property owner as having sufficient property-based interest to exclude the contractor employees. And here we find that both of them cut in the same direction, but we could have done it based on either ground. That in that situation, if we thought that the application of one of those, regularity, exclusivity, is arbitrary, then would you still say, well, you have to remand? Or would you say, well, no, there's another one that was also found to be in the property owner's favor, and so we'd have to win both?
No, I the way I understand the board's test, and I think this is quite clear, is that you don't reach what I'm calling step two, Your Honor called step three, the reasonable alternative, that you don't even reach that if you don't get past the first step of regular and exclusive.
I think that's true. I mean, so let's just to be clear, let's say 1A, 1B, and 2.
Okay.
So we're on the same numerical letter framework.
Yes.
Then I guess, so the question would be, is the one grouping and two, are they independent? Are they potentially independent? Or is the board saying you can only ever get to two if there's regularity and exclusivity under one? And I see if you're right that you can only ever get to two if the employer, if the property owner wins on 1A, 1B, then I understand what you're saying. But if the board is saying, yeah, that's typically how you do it, but I mean, obviously, you can just skip straight to two if the property owner is going to win it or two anyway.
I don't read the board's decision that way. I think that they're very clear that you have to surmount 1A and 1B before you even get to two.
I guess what I was asking before is to tell us more in your view why. I understand that there's a reading of the board's opinion that runs that way. And what I was saying was, my understanding of that roughly was it's only when there's a non-regular and non-exclusive workplace at the premises that those workers then become akin to the union organizers in Lechmere and therefore subject to that more readily met employer analysis about alternative means. Because you don't usually apply, for example, to an alternative means inquiry to full employees of an employer at a workplace, right?
Correct.
So that was sort of what I was posing as like asking, is that your theory? And I thought you were a little bit pushing back on that before. So I'm just trying to understand your theory of the board's opinion and what the logic is that the alternative means inquiry only arises if the workplace is either not the regular place of work for these employees or not the exclusive place.
Okay, I'm gonna try to sort all this out because I apologize if I've confused you, Your Honor. So two things. One is we're very clear, our reading of the board's decision is that you only reach step two if the employees meet steps 1A and step 1B in the chief judge's schema. So the reason the board, and I think it's clear from particularly the outset of the board's decision, the reason the board wrote its test this way is that it wanted to limit to a very great degree the right of contractor employees to exercise their rights on a proper third-party property owner's property. So it was intentionally written so you both had to show regularity and exclusivity. And you had to show that no alternative means were available. So you would not even reach step two without completing step one. I think I may have created some confusion. I understood you, Judge Pillard, to be asking whether there was another test that could theoretically the board in another case could articulate that would use the step two differently in a different manner, whether the step two could ever be appropriate for contract employees. And my answer to that was, Perhaps, yes. I mean, the board has discretion to put together a test, and you could imagine a scenario where that was part of its test, but it wouldn't be this test. This test, we think, is arbitrary. For the reasons we said in the brief, I know I'm out of time. I'm happy to keep answering questions.
Could you just fill us in a little bit, why is this test arbitrary, assuming that these employees were not regular employees at this site?
Well,
Then what's defective about this test?
So what's defective about the test is that it, remember, the background from this court's decision in New York 2 is that the board has discretion, but must require this, must accommodate the Section 7 interest and the property interest. Here, the exclusivity test is so stringent. If you ever work,
I was saying, assume they're not, I'm putting aside, actually on purpose, putting aside the exclusivity prong, just saying, assume they fail the regularity prong. They're really just not regularly employed there. Do you, in that situation, is this version of the alternative means analysis still defective? And if so, why?
I guess my understanding, again, of the board's decision is that if a particular set of contract employees did not meet the regularity part of the test, you would not then go to part two. Now, it might be in that case that the employees who, having being told they are the functional equivalent of non-employees, could come in and make a straightforward Leachmere claim. Say, you know, you've told us we're just like non-employees, so we're going to try to meet the Leachmere test. But under the way the board has written its decision here, we think it's very clear that you don't get to step two if you're not regularly employed.
Now, that seems like that has to be right, because for the way the board's constructed the inquiry, the property owner has to win on both regularity and exclusivity in order to not get to two. Otherwise,
right? I guess right. You're right. I that was a non-question question. I see the problem. But let's say that the board is looking at facts and saying, well, we could either go on non-regularity or go on availability of alternative means. And this is, again, we're just probing the sequence question and why it's sequential. Could the board, without finding one way or the other on regularity, say, well, in any event, there were adequate alternative means? Because I guess I'm thinking going forward, if we were to accept the board's test as consistent with the property rights and Section 7, would it be open to employers simply to go straight to alternative means and just say, well, there's the internet, well, there's the internet? And obviously, this is something we can ask to Ms. Rajapakse, but in your view is no, they couldn't. They actually have to first be determined to be in this category of employees who are not regularly and exclusively.
So I think, Judge Pillard, so an employer, I assume under the board's test articulated here, could come in and say, look, we'll make it simple for you. They don't meet test prong two, so you don't even have to get into prong one. That may be true for the employer, but for the employees can't, this is what's so wrong with the test, is if you are a non-employee union organizer on Leachmere, all you have to do is come in, not that it's easy, but come in and say, hey, look, there's no reasonable alternative means of communication available. We have to be let on the property. But the way the board has articulated its test, a contractor employee not only has to make that showing, but then it has to go back and make the other showing that they're regularly and exclusively employed on the property. So the way the board has articulated its test is it holds contractor employees who have personal Section 7 interests to a higher standard than non-employee union organizers. And we just think that can't be right. So I think you're right that an employer could do that. But from the employee's point of view, you have to meet both prongs of the test in order to be able to access the property to exercise your Section 7 rights. And we think that just cannot be correct. It's not on the continuum between Republic Aviation and Leachmere. So,
okay, thank you.
If there are no further questions, if I could have a minute or two for rebuttal.
Judge Henderson has a question.
Oh, yes.
I have questions. I may be on a frolic of my own, but I have a hard time seeing the Section 7 right here. I know it's given. I know it's not a given. I know it's not contested. But it's like that movie or book, six or seven degrees, whatever it is, of separation. You've got a property owner that's not the subject of the leafleting. You've got a licensee of that property owner whose beef which is characterized by the ALJ as, quote, to increase their employment opportunities in conjunction with the performances of the ballet, nothing to do with Tobin Center. Its beef is with not the property owner, but with another licensee. And I guess my question is this, could these musicians hand out leaflets that attacked something that was unfair to them, they felt, from Majestic Theater? In other words, they weren't being paid enough by Majestic Theater. Not that they were using canned music like the ballet was.
You mean that could they hand out leaflets at Tobin Center about another employer?
Well,
another venue.
The Tobin Center is not their employer. And here's the problem I see. New York, those ARC employees who worked in restaurants and supplied all the food for the casino, they wanted to join the same union that the casino employees were members of. And the same union organizing, so forth, all the way down the line with these cases. And now you have a case where one licensee is fighting another licensee that the property owner doesn't have a dog in that fight. And so what would stop these musicians from stopping the patrons of the Tobin Center with leaflets that say, we don't make enough from Majestic Theater? And while I'm thinking about it, another question is this. You've sort of thrown off on the social media as the alternative access. But if you look at the leaflet, it takes you to Facebook or FaceTime, whatever it is. And when you get there, it's a plea to, as they put it, the big dog donors of the opera, the ballet, and the symphony. And then they say, quote, even the Tobin Center, the big dog donors of the Tobin Center. So that's a long-winded wind-up.
Well, I'll do my best. So okay. I think, you know, the key point I want to emphasize here is that the musicians already had a relationship with all three of the principal resident companies. So this is not like a stranger employer at the Tobin Center in the ballet. They regularly perform for the ballet, as for the opera, as for the symphony.
Okay, but they're a stranger as to the fight between the two licensees. I mean, the musicians could have had a agreement with the ballet just like they did with the opera. Tobin Center could have, or they could have in their use agreement with Tobin Center, all of them reached this issue of the canned music versus the live music.
Right. I think the point I want to emphasize is that in the case law, a demand to hire union members, a demand on an employer to hire union members, is right at the core of Section 7 protected activity. So in Phelps Dodge, which is a very early Supreme Court case, in this court's decision in Venetian Casino Resort, it's not disputed in this case. Nobody,
right.
It's not,
right.
But that demand to hire union members, and here it's not a stretch at all, as we've shown and is clear in the record. You know, the musicians, they work for all three of these organizations. So yes, they are not employees of the Tobin Center, but this is the locus. This is the physical location where this core labor dispute is taking place. They're not talking about a labor dispute at some other location. You know, the ballet only performs, in fact, at the Tobin Center. So
I had a similar question to Judge Henderson, which is that it's true that in this case, the Tobin Center has arrangements with both the symphony and the ballet. You could imagine a situation in which the ballet just performed elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And the employees would have no particular association with that other place, because as you rightly say, the symphony employees primarily perform at the Tobin Center. So then you could imagine a situation in which then the Symphony employees want to go to the Tobin Center and try to put pressure on Symphony consumers, because there's some overlap between Symphony consumers and ballet consumers who, by hypothesis, work elsewhere, who are performed elsewhere. And then, as Judge Henderson points out, from the perspective of the property owner, from the Tobin Center, they're probably thinking, well, why is all this happening on my property? Because I don't have anything to do with the ballet. You're complaining about what the ballet is doing. The ballet's performing somewhere else, but what? Why am I being required to accommodate the leafletting on my property for a ballet that doesn't even perform here? Now here, it's true that the ballet does perform there, but you could sort of say, well, that happens to be true, but it's still one extra step removed because the Tobin Center just happens to contract with both the symphony and the ballet. And so it's a little different than the New York situation, where the reason ARC employees are there on the property is because those are ARC restaurants. Those are ARC food establishments. And they're trying to tell the folks there, well, look, ARC ought to be unionized. And this one just feels one step removed. Now, one answer is, even if the board could make something of, one possible answer is, even if the board could make something of that, that there's nothing in the board's decision that suggests that there was any, that they saw a distinction between this situation and the New York situation. So at least, you know, the board would have to spell out why that could matter. But I think you understand the factual point, which I think,
yes,
I hope
I do.
I'm not mischaracterizing.
No, and you what you just stated, Your Honor, is what I was going to state, which is that the board did not base its decision in any way on that distinction. And I would, again, this is a different arrangement than New York, but I would push back against the idea that it's a less direct Section 7 interest. I mean, it's obviously, it's just a different arrangement when you have three performing arts companies working at the property. But what this court has instructed is you look at the property interest, which is in this case is an interest that, you know, deals with management of the property and is mediated through the contractual relationships between the property owner and the employers using the property.
But Mr. Ginsburg, I guess a difference is that these employees are not trying to unionize vis-a-vis the ballet, right?
I think it's clear from the record that they're trying to, they are unionized already. They're trying to obtain work, whether directly with the ballet, as it did with the opera. They could either work directly with the ballet, as they did with the opera, or through the symphony. And I think the record's quite clear that either way would be a way in which they were pursuing their own Section 7 interests.
Let me ask you something, Mr. Ginsburg, that you said that raises a hypothetical question. You said the thrust of the leaflet was hire union members. And as you said that, I thought, instead of canned music. What would you say if they replaced, if the hire union members as opposed to robots? I would think that would be a legitimate Section 7 complaint.
I guess I'm not sure that I see the distinction. I agree that both are right at the core of Section 7. Seeking work for themselves, whether it's instead of recorded music or robots.
In other words, you would think hire union members as opposed to non-member non-union members. And here we have hire union members rather than using canned music. And my question was, and I know it's not raised here, if assuming that's a Section 7 right, would a Section 7 right be even clearer if the message were hire union members as opposed to robots on an assembly line, let's say?
Mm-hmm. I think, as the record shows, the musicians here signed a separate collective bargaining agreement with the opera to perform Macbeth.
Right.
They reached a different deal. If next season, when the opera wanted to perform Macbeth again, they decided to perform using robots, I think that the musician's interest on being on the property and handing out leaflets saying, use live music, use union members, not robots, would be pretty close to identical to what was going on here, right at the core of their own personal non-derivative Section 7 rights.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg. We'll hear from Ms. Rajapakse now, and we'll give you some rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Ms. Rajapakse.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Meelakshmi Rajapaksa, and I'm counsel for the National Labor Relations Board. The board in this case reasonably exercised its discretion to revise its standard for determining when the off-duty employees of an on-site contractor have a Section 7 right of access to the property not owned by their own employer. And I guess I will kind of cut to the chase in a sense and address this idea that the board's test is arbitrary or overly strict. The first part of the test, to be clear, consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Hudgens, really tests and evaluates the employee's Section 7 interest in leafleting or engaging in Section 7 activity on this property. So that is where the regularly and exclusively requirements come in. At the second stage of the test, the board considers, and this is assuming that the employees do work regularly and exclusively on the property, the board proceeds to the second question of alternative means, which is again consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Babcock and Wilcox, that Section 7 rights surely should be accommodated, but with as little destruction of property rights as possible.
So can I direct you to the first part of the test then, and what we'd called 1A and 1B versus 2? So let's just say 1A is regularity, because I just want to talk about regularity for a second.
Okay.
And then there's going to be some questions about how all these interrelate and whether 2 does independent, can be deemed to be independently sufficient. But just to isolate 1A for a second, regularity. So in regularity, the board's decision says at footnote 56, that, for example, a contractor employee who stocks vending machines once a week at the property owner's facility works regularly. And then the board's decision goes on to say, regularity is not satisfied here because it's only 22 weeks. I don't understand how that's consistent, because if 1 out of 7 is regular, how is 22 out of 52 not regular?
I think the board looked at the record, the specific record in this case, Your Honor, and what the record shows is that these musicians have a variable weekly schedule. Sometimes they don't work at the Tobin Center at all. Sometimes they work just a few hours a week.
So there's nothing, as far as I can tell. You could conceive of regularity in two ways. I grant you that. One could be regularity means frequency, and that's where 1/7 and 22 out of 52, you do a comparison. You could have another conception of regularity that's sort of like, you know, definite and predictable, like it's Monday, Wednesday, Friday, as opposed to 3 days for you to choose, and therefore we don't know. But I see nothing in the board's decision at all that talks about that second form of regularity. It's all about frequency. And when they apply the test to these facts, all the board says is it's only 22 weeks. That's all that's said. And if that's true, I don't understand how 22 out of 52 is not regular, but 1 out of 7. And even 1 out of 7 is overstating it, because when the vending machine person goes, they're not there for the entire day. They're only there presumably for a few minutes to restock. So you're talking about one day, but a few minutes of that one day. But still, I'll just grant you the full day. But if 1 out of 7 is regular and we're only talking about frequency, how is 22 out of 52 not regular?
Right, the board defines regular somewhat in opposition to sporadically or occasionally or on an ad hoc basis. And so I think the board's view in this case, and this is clear from its application of the regularity requirement to the musicians, the board looks at whether there is some kind of uniformity in terms of their, or literally regularity in their presence on this property. And so the board was, yes, looking at the 22 weeks, but I think the board is also looking at how much, whether there's any sort of uniformity.
Then would you grant me then that I don't see uniformity in here at all? I don't see it. And I'm not even sure, I'll get to this question too. I don't even understand how uniformity could possibly matter. But anyways, would you at least grant me that if we're talking about what I take to be the normal understanding of regularity, especially for purposes of what the connection is to the property, which is frequency, I can understand why frequency has a direct bearing on significance of connection to property, because if there's a difference between somebody who works at a property 1 week out of 52 and somebody who works 51 weeks out of 52, that's just a different level of connection. So if we're talking about frequency, would you grant that it seems arbitrary to say on one hand that 1 out of 7 is regular and 22 out of 52 is not?
No, Your Honor, I don't
No,
think...
even on frequency, you would say it's okay to say that 1 out of 7 is regular, but 22 out of 52 is irregular.
Well, the board is not applying a frequency requirement. The board
But I'm asking you to assume that it is. I don't see how it's not a frequency requirement. That all what I see in this opinion over and over is it's only 22 out of 52, which all I read into that is frequency. If that's the way I read it, I'm not trying to deny you the argument that my premise is wrong. I'm just asking you for purposes of argument to accept the premise. If you accept the premise, it seems to me arbitrary to say on one hand that 1 out of 7 is regular, but 22 out of 52 is not.
22 out of 52 is less than half of the year. I mean,
so
that's
is 1 out of 7. It's more less than 1/2 of the year than is 22 out of 52. That's the point, is that 1 out of 7 is less than 22 out of 52. Then how can the first one be regular and the second one not?
Right. This is where the idea of intervals, I think, is important.
Okay.
I mean,
so on frequency,
no regularity
that just means
to the
that on frequency, then that just means on frequency, if it's only, I have not heard you say, and I think I understand why you wouldn't, because I don't see how one could say that if it's just a frequency based determination, then 1/7 has to, if 1/7 is regular, then 22 out of 52 has to be regular too. Then we have to get to whether regularity actually means something different from frequency, like, you know, definite intervals. And on that, A, I don't see anything in the opinion that says that, but even if it did, I don't understand that because, for example, employees all the time take vacation. They get 2 weeks of vacation. No one knows when that vacation is gonna happen. They just pick when it's gonna happen. So the fact that you don't exactly know what happens in a particular week, I don't understand how that bears on the strength of the connection to a property, the property in a way that would really tip the balance.
Well, the board, that's precisely the point of the board's decision, is that the board doesn't look at individual employee schedules in making this assessment about regularity or exclusivity. The board is looking at the contractor's presence on the property.
But even the contractor's presence on the property, I didn't mean to draw the distinction between contractors and employees. I'm saying even the contractor, if you know that they're going to work there, the contractor's going to be there 22 out of 52 weeks. And you know that there's 13 weeks as to which they can't be there at all because it's a 39-week season. So we're talking about which 22 out of the 39 weeks. That's really the question, right? And if we're talking about which 22 out of the 39 weeks, what does it matter that you don't know which exact weeks it is? If it's 22 out of 39, we know it's 22 out of 39. Why does it matter if we don't know exactly which weeks is going to be? And by the way, I'm not even sure that you don't know, but yeah. even if you assume that you don't, why would that matter?
The board really is, again, Your Honor, I don't want to reject the premise of your question, but the board really said regularity and it meant regularity, and it distinguished regularity from sporadic or occasional.
So seasonal nurses in, beach town who then go to the, ski areas and the hospitals and the ski areas in the winter, not covered because they're coming and going.
It's not that they're not covered by the act. They certainly could be, and the musicians in this case are. The question is just whether they have a Section 7 access right.
Right.
And the board's position is that these employees, first of all, start out as non-employees of the property owner, and that's sort of the linchpin of the board's decision. Because they're non-employees, of course, their right of access is more restricted than the rights of employees of the property owner. And so corresponding to that, it's a more demanding test.
So in terms of the board's understanding of how much latitude it had under New York 1, in your view, could the board have just said, okay, these are not employees of the Tobin Center. So the Babcock-Leuchmere standard applies to them, period. Without the burden. I know the board hung a lot on this burden shift, but without that, is that as you read New York, is that permissible under New York to just to go all the way to the pole of non-employee?
Right. I think that the court's 2002 New York decision does give the board that latitude to determine the status of these employees for access purposes. And so the board and the court specifically said employees or non-employees. The board in New York and this case chose kind of an intermediate position where it recognizes that these are employees of an employer. So they are, broadly speaking, employees under the statute. But
it's the board's position that they actually don't need to be between the polls of the non-employees who have no Section 7 rights in Lechmere and employees of an employer that owns the premises. They could have no showing whatsoever, alternative means, they're on a lessee's, a property that's leased to their employer.
That's
within no access rights. They have no access rights. That was open to the board.
The board did not choose that path, and the board has always maintained that this situation is not governed by Lechmere or Babcock. And there are distinctions, to be fair, between employees under the statute and non-employee union organizers. And the board's decision is very rational in the sense that it takes that distinction into account just as much as it takes the distinction between a property owner's employees and these contractor employees into account. And that's both in New York, and in this case.
So in this case, the Tobin Center did not have a burden before the ALJ when the record was being developed to show adequate alternative means.
That's right.
So it can't have met that burden.
Well, on the record, it did meet the burden, though, because it was able to show, it did adduce evidence that these employees leafleted without any problem across the street from the Tobin Center. And it also adduced evidence that they handed out hundreds of leaflets over the course of the weekend.
But there's There's no findings on those facts by the ALJ.
Right, but the facts are in the record. And so the board relied on the facts in the record.
And the union was not aware whether it had to dispute numbers of leaflets or distances from where the traffic was going or proportion of patrons who are getting out of valet parking on the, what's the name of the circle, the auditorium circle, or you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do, but I don't know the name. Yeah.
There was no exploration of those facts before the ALJ, auditorium circle.
Well, there was, Your Honor, in the sense that you know, there is under New York, this idea of interference with the property owner's business. That is sort of the second stage of analysis under New York, which is what the ALJ applied. And so the parties were on notice that these concepts of interference were at issue. And in the course of litigating that, these facts came in about where the musicians leafleted and were they blocking ingress and egress and things of that nature.
I thought that was that the principal rule was simply we have no solicitation policy, and therefore everything has to take place off our property, and that wasn't contested. That was the property owner's property claim. So there was no interference with its property. And then you had the leafleters outside the perimeter. And then the question becomes, they're outside the perimeter, so there's full protection of the property rights. Are they being given an adequate alternative means of serving their Section 7 access rights? And that's not an inquiry, is it, under New York?
Do we know
on this, I'm looking at JA 486, do we know on this exhibit, there's numbers and letters on here, where the ballet patrons enter the building? Is it across from Veterans Memorial Park in that main sort of colonnade entrance, or
right? We do know from the record that they entered. They reached the main entrance from multiple different points. So there are,
where is the main entrance? Just for my benefit, is it that big entrance?
Yes,
from the plaza.
Right.
Veterans Plaza, it's sort of the curved part of the facing toward the river.
Right. And so the musicians wanted to leaflet on the perimeter around that plaza to catch patrons coming in from different points. But they were actually able to reach at least some patrons from across the street from the Tobin Center.
So they were across the street, either in Veterans Memorial Park or across Auditorium Circle away from the building?
I believe it was across Auditorium Circle.
On the sidewalk there. So people would be coming into Valet Park, they would get out and they would walk straight over to the, I guess, is that the west, toward the entrance.
Right, and there are also multiple parking lots.
Right.
And so theoretically.
Do you know where those are on the?
I don't actually, Your Honor, I don't have the map in front of me. But there were some.
I didn't see that in the record. I think that might have been in the record, but not the record that was supplied to us in the appendix. I don't think that part was included about where most people were coming from and parking and what their walking paths would have been.
I can look again at what was put in the joint appendix, Your Honor. But I believe all of the maps were put in. Mr. Ginsburg might be more able to clarify this than I would be, but the point is that there were surrounding parking lots and there was valet parking, and some of the patrons did enter by crossing the street to the Tobin Center, so they necessarily would have come in contact with the leafleters as they were crossing.
So if this were different facts, and I recognize this is a different hypothetical, if there were a freestanding theater that a theater company leased from a property owner, and the property owner said, look, it's all yours to do with as you wish, let's say year round, just to put the first prongs A and B off the table. But the property owner provides security and has a policy of no leafleting. In that case, if the property owner is enforcing that against employees of the theater who want to leaflet on theater property, let's say like this, sidewalks around a theater that are owned by the theater, no Section 7 rights, because in fact, in that situation, they're non-employees of the property owner.
I just want to make sure that I'm following. So the theater is leasing the property from the property owner and its employees are attempting to leaflet. I think that would be a different situation, Your Honor, because these are, this case is specifically about contractor employees. So in your hypothetical, there's no contractor relationship.
But it would be, the contract here is a lease agreement, right? It's a license agreement for the symphony to be present. So it would be, it's a contractor of the property owner in that sense. They're employees of the theater company, but they're contractors with contract employees with vis-a-vis the property owner. They're not the employees of the property owner.
Right.
So in that sense, they are the employees of a licensee of the property owner. And I'm just trying to understand what, if anything, would distinguish that case from this case. And I understand all the 1A, 1B, regular and exclusive, but putting that aside, and just looking at this access question, why wouldn't the same access analysis be applicable there?
If the relationship, in fact, is a contractor relationship
with
the property owner, then this test would apply. Yes. But it's a little, I will say, Your Honor, it's a little bit complicated because in a lease situation, the lessee gets exclusive possession of certain parts of the property. And theoretically, they could control within their leasehold, you know, the what employees have rights to do and so on. And then Section 7 would apply a little differently within the lease.
Right. But I'm just thinking if I were a theater company and I wanted to provide the kind of, I wanted to rent, you know, lease a theater, and one was offering me some security and a no hand billing policy and the other wasn't, I would think, you know, fewer problems for me. I'm going to contract for the one that's giving me some security and a no hand billing agreement. And that would, you know, put this property owner in the same relationship with the employees as the Tobin here. I grant, putting aside the fact that there are in fact multiple licensees at the Tobin Center. And so getting to the question about the alternative means, there's a mention in there's no testimony about this, I don't think, although you'll correct me if I'm wrong, about the use of social media or any finding of adequacy of kinds of social media. But the board does talk about, on the one hand, avenues of distributing handbills from across the street, but also about social and mass media. If the musicians here were not able to distribute leaflets across the street, could the NLRB have reached the same conclusion on this record that it reached because of the availability of mass and public media, social media?
I think that is the board's position, is that in this case that those other avenues would have been reasonable alternatives. And again, and I think the board explores this somewhat at page 9 of the slip opinion, where it talks about the alternative avenues analysis. In this case, the employees were attempting to communicate with the general public. And for that purpose, Facebook and so on, and especially because they were ultimately trying to direct people to a Facebook page with a QR code, electronic means would have been adequate in the board's view. But in terms of the application of this in other cases, it is not the case, and the board is pretty emphatic about this, it is not the case that in every situation a property owner can simply say Facebook or Twitter and they will be relieved of their burden to show anything further. And
so say more about that. What do we know about that?
Well, at footnote 85 of the board's decision, the board says that it will not speculate about what would constitute reasonable alternative non-trespassory means in every case or in any other case. And the board is simply in this case saying that such means could be reasonable, especially because increasingly employees are communicating both amongst themselves and with the public through electronic means.
I'm sorry, you said footnote which?
85.
It was 85.
Can I take you back to exclusivity for 1 second? Because there's the link here too. So I'm not understanding why exclusivity matters, except that in prior decisions, at least from the dissenting member that was relied on by, was it Hayes? I can't remember, but
it was Hayes.
Yes.
Yeah, that was relied on. There's a suggestion that exclusivity matters because in a non-exclusive situations, there are other places where the Section 7 rights can be exercised because there's other property.
Right.
Is that the way in which exclusivity matters, or is there some other way? Because I don't understand, as a rational matter, why exclusivity matters other than that.
Right, I think that is the rationale for the exclusivity piece of the analysis. And the board does kind of say, by way of a quote from the Postal Service case, this is page 8 of the decision, that when employees work regularly and exclusively, you have kind of an East Tech sort of situation that arises where they have no other plays, no other work plays where they can exercise their Section 7 rights. So of course the board takes that seriously, and that becomes the jumping off point for access rights.
So then if that's the only way in which exclusivity matters, and I think I agree that that is the only way I can understand why exclusivity would matter, because otherwise it seems irrational to think that if you work on a property 5 weeks, then the fact that you happen to work only on that property for those 5 weeks somehow gives you a greater connection to a property than one in which you work for 22 weeks, but then you work for a handful of weeks somewhere else too, right? So then if we're only talking about the fact that there's another avenue that's available, another place, another piece of property that's available for the exercise of Section 7 rights, then does there have to be some kind of assessment of whether in fact the other place is available or how it stacks up? Because otherwise, why does it matter? Do you see what I'm saying? It's in theory possible that there's some other place. Now, we have no idea what the strength of the connection is to that other place though. And it could be that that other place, if you're only working there for 1 hour a year and you're spending 99% of your time at location A and 1% of your time at location B, then it could very well be the case. I mean, if I were property owner B, I would probably be thinking, wait a minute, that means that the leafleting has to occur on my property instead of the place where 99% of the activity occurs. That I'm not understanding how that squares unless you take into account the availability of the other property, but maybe I'm missing something.
Well, the board isn't getting into those fine assessments, Your Honor, about how long people spend as a proportion of all their working time at various different properties. The board is really laying down kind of a bright line rule that in order to acquire an access right, these employees have to work exclusively at this property. So even if they work 1 hour elsewhere, unfortunately, that is sufficient to sort of break the necessary connection in the board's view.
But there has to be a reason that matters. Now, of course, mathematically, you're right that there's a difference between, you know, 90% and 100%. That's just math. That's a mathematical identity, and nobody could dispute that. But there has to be a reason why the difference between 90% and 100% matters in a way that's commensurate with the values that are in the balance. And I guess it's not apparent to me why that difference matters, unless it's because there's another potential forum that's available. And if that's true, then the other potential forum, it seems to me, has to be available, or else there's no difference.
Right. The board really didn't address in this case the situation that you're talking about, Your Honor, because in this case, it was abundantly clear that these employees don't work exclusively on the Tobin Center's property for this contractor. And that's sort of where the analysis ended as far as that first part of the case. Mm-hmm. So the board didn't get into, I think, the analysis that the union is suggesting, which is more of a practical assessment of where employees actually can exercise their.
I'm not sure it's just a practical question. It seems to me it's a theoretical one, in that to focus on exclusivity, there has to be some reason why that focus makes sense. It can't be just arbitrary. You can't just say, well, we care about exclusivity. Well, why? Because exclusivity matters. I mean, that's just tautological, so it doesn't tell you anything. And so there has to be some underlying value that's being served by focusing on exclusivity. And if the underlying value is there's the potential availability of another forum, it just seems to me that there would have to be some work done in association with that, or else it's just exclusivity for exclusivity's sake, which I'm not quite following why.
Wait, I think the board is coming at this a little bit differently though, Your Honor. You're talking about the availability of another forum. The board actually is concerned with whether this is the only forum. Like it's looking at the connection to this property and not the availability of other properties. Do you see what I'm saying? The board is literally concerned with what it said in its decision, whether there is no other place, and that is all. The board is not looking at, are there available other places? It's framing the question a little bit differently.
Is the salience of that from the perspective of the leafleting employees or from the perspective of the property owner on whose property the leafleting occurs?
I think the board is looking at the perspective of the employees. The board is concerned about whether these employees truly have no other place. And so that it sort of, but it also does, of course, take into account the property owner's right to exclude and the fact that the property owner could well say, well, why my property? And the answer would be because these employees have no other place to exercise their Section 7 rights. And that is why some dislocation of your rights is necessary. In terms of the application, I know I've far exceeded my time. I won't get into it unless the court has questions about the facts.
What were you just going to say?
Oh, no, I was just going to recap that in the board's view, I take Judge Srinivasan's point that 22 weeks may seem fairly substantial, but in the board's view, respectfully, that does not suffice to meet the regularity requirement. And obviously the record is very clear that these employees don't work exclusively on the Tobin Center's property. So really the board could have stopped there, but it did proceed to the second stage of the analysis. And I just wanna briefly say in terms of a point that was raised earlier in this argument, the board could theoretically, if it knows that the employer is going to win on the second stage of the analysis, it could assume for the sake of argument that the first yes. stage is met. And that's how it would kind of get yes. to the second stage. And with that, I will close. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Rajapaksa. Mr. Ginsburg, we'll give you your 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, and I'll be brief. First, I just want to reiterate, we believe that if you agree with us that the board's application of its first step of the first step of the board's test is arbitrary and its application to the facts of this case was unreasonable, that you should remand this case to the board. You don't need to reach the second step.
No guidance on that? We don't need to give any guidance on second step?
Well, I think some of the discussion
For reasons that Ms. Rajapaksa just said, it seems like actually the second step is where all the action is, because if it's such a weak, easily met standard, then it could always be the avenue taken.
Yes, and absolutely this court should give guidance. And what I would say is that the reason the first step is dispositive here is that you can't rationally do the second step, in a real way of determining whether alternative means of communication are reasonable without knowing the strength of the Section 7 interest at issue. So, and that is guidance that this court could provide to the board. So, for example, the board said, you know, these were communications to the general public, so it could be done across the street or by social media. That's fine. We don't think that's what the record shows. You know, here the employees, the musicians, were seeking to specifically communicate with people who were entering the ballet for the opening performance of the ballet. Sure, they caught some of them across the street, but as the ALJ found, you know, standing closer to the entrance was going to catch basically all of them. And imagine, you know, the board's rule applies to the musicians if they had a contract dispute with the symphony over pay, for example. And if an hour before the symphony's performance, they handed out leaflets saying, hello, patrons, you know, please, you know us, we're the musicians. Please support us in our contract dispute with the symphony. You know, please call the symphony. Under the board's rule, they couldn't do that. And yet that's exactly the same Section 7 activity that was at issue here. So if there are no further questions.
That's not right.
And on the symphony, you're saying that would be the same rule because the symphony is also a contractor, or what?
The board's rule, its finding here would apply to the musicians when they sought to leaflet if the symphony was performing as opposed to the ballet, excuse me.
Right. Because
because they found that the musicians were not regularly and exclusively employed at the location. I will continue if you'd like, but I didn't think so.
Oh no, I think I understand that point.
Yeah. So and we think that, you know, that can't possibly be the case, and so that any balancing at the second step needs to take into account what Section 7 interest is at issue. Here, it's clear that the issue is a personal, non-derivative interest of employees who work at the location. And so, you know, that is certainly some guidance that the court could give to the board on remand. How the board articulates its test, as we've discussed throughout this argument, would be, you know, there's a number of ways they could do it. But the point is that they have to have a test that considers both the property interest and the Section 7 interest and balances them. And you have to know what the Section 7 interest is in order to accomplish that balancing.
Isn't the Section 7, at what level of granularity does one parse the Section 7 interest? I mean, if you have the same ability to proceed to communicate with members of the public as you do with your own employer, and so these patrons, communications with the patrons are fair game. What more about the nature of the interest would cast light on the alternative means? I mean, I get your point about the ballet patrons being the target, and so you have to assess whether the alternative means allows them to reach those. I understand that. But are there other factors that would bear on the strength of the Section 7 right that you're thinking about that would this a much more case-by-case variable inquiry, the Section 7 inquiry?
Well, I mean, there are other factors, but they don't particularly come into play here, because here all the musicians were doing were standing in an outside non-working area of the property. And it's very clear from the board's and this court's case law that that's generally a place that's appropriate to communicate with customers of your employer. You know, New York leaned very heavily on ITT, and that's what that was about. So there are a number of questions that can be raised in those cases. In Nova Southeast, which is one of the cases discussed, that's from this court, there was some discussion about the particular location where the employer does not have a leasehold interest, but there's, you know, there the employee was leafleting in the parking lot, he was leafleting to his co-employees, and they said that's, the board said and you affirmed that that was an appropriate locus because that's where the communication most naturally would take place. So there are those sorts of concerns. They run throughout the board's decisions over many years and this court's decisions. But again, I think in this case, speaking to the customers as they enter the very door of the Tobin Center about the labor dispute is outside in a non-working area is firmly within the board and this court's sense of what is a traditional and appropriate place for employees to exercise their Section 7 rights.
If you don't counteract the property owner's rights.
Right, and we acknowledge...
That's just an observation.
Right, and we acknowledge that there has to be some balancing, but balancing that takes account of the Section 7 interest of the employees, which in this case we think are very strong as this is where they work. If there are no further questions, we'll rest. Yes. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.